Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
And welcome to episode 202 of Geek Town Radio. I'm back this week with Gray.
Hello.
I've got my soundboard working again.
Hey, good to hear myself. My little lead in there.
Yes, yes. Seen any good movies this week? I mean, I don't know what we're going to talk about.
There wasn't anything really out, was
there? No. What was that like little superhero film?
I think it's that one that came on the end of a couple of other films that ran before it.
Yeah.
Yes, Dave, I did, of course, see Endgame. It's why I'm back so quickly. I was only on a few weeks back.
Yes.
Obviously, I wanted to come back, talk about Endgame. And obviously in my other life as a teacher, I had to be on hot alert as many of my students decided that they would go and see the midnight showing.
Wow.
And I wasn't seeing it until the Thursday evening.
What's really funny is I've seen a couple of people post about teachers that had managed to get out and see it before the students. And when the kids were playing around in class, he was slowly writing Endgame spoilers on the whiteboard. So every time they messed up or every time they messed around, it was like Thanos and does.
Yeah, there was a little bit of tension between a couple of children. I was like, if you come in tomorrow and you say anything to me, there will be repercussions. So I was very firm. I had my teacher voice on. But then on Thursday night, I went out and I obviously did see it. And it was everything I hoped it would be and more. We'll start spoiler free and just sort of say the storytelling, the piecing together, the idea behind the narrative to give that true honor to everything that came before, and all the work Feige and his team had put into those movies since 2008 was exactly what we wanted. And the cinema I was in, and I know many cinemas across the country, the people I've been speaking to, were just honoring it so much. And I am in fully respect social media over the weekend. I respect sort of like the ethos that was out there where people were keeping it from and honoring, like, keep it to yourself, people experience the end game. And if you were lucky enough to get into a cinema before anyone had spoiled it, then I hope you appreciate how beautiful the movie was, and how right it was to summarize the story. I thought it was brilliant. And so there's my spoiler free review of that weekend and the situation.
Absolutely. I mean, social media has actually been done really well managing to keep a lid on it. There have been a few idiots out there that have been spoiling stuff, but generally I haven't seen anything that's been overly kind of, you know, even the media outlets have been very, very careful about it. Speaking of which, we are going to go into spoilers on it now. What I will do is I will come back from the future and tell you how long the spoiler bit is. So I will slot that in here. Jump forward 14 minutes, 47 seconds. That's 14 minutes, 47 seconds. So thank you, Future Dave, for that. And we're going to go in and talk about spoilers. What I'll also do is I'll put some music underneath the spoiler bit. So if you happen to jump forward and you've not jumped forward far enough and you can still hear music underneath, jump forward a bit more. So we are going into spoilers. This is a spoiler alert.
Spoilers.
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 Now there's a spoiler.
Spoilers for Endgame, you have been warned.
So, yes, over Easter, me and a few friends decided to do some binge watching of the MCU world.
Yes.
So on one day, we did five films. We did the original Avengers, we did Guardians of the Galaxy, we did Civil War, we did Winter Soldier, and we did Age of Ultron.
Yes.
And then with another set of friends, I did Doctor Strange, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and obviously we've seen Infinity War before. And we resolved that those were some of the best films to have watched. It's almost like we'd planned it, because the drop-in of the narratives from across those really worked for what you saw in Endgame.
Yeah.
Even choosing the right Guardians of the Galaxy 1 to watch, to understand like the Power Stone and things like that, and you know, that again, really well done. So we were pleased with ourselves, and I think that's really important for the real hardcore MCU fans to have that bit of time before to appreciate some of the films and revisit them. Even though some people say they're hardcore, going back and revisiting and remembering was really quite important, especially as you were getting into some of the time jumps and thinking, right, okay, I remember that. And you were then trying to work out, was that extra or was that some actual footage? And I just think the Russos did so well there, because it was almost flawless that that could have been extracted straight out of the previous movies. I thought time would take a big part of it, and up until that point I was still confident it would be something to do with time and something to do with the quantum realm. So when that came out, sort of a little cheer to myself in the cinema, like, yes, I think. But you know, I thought there's 90% of people out there were convinced Ant-Man was so key. That what Doctor Strange had said would obviously link back to time and sort of that. So that's, I was very proud of the narrative going in that way. And if you'd spent that time watching the films before, that was really quite important.
What was quite interesting was that opening, killing that version of Thanos really quite early. And like, that's interesting. And then suddenly there's this 5-year time jump and you're like, oh, that I wasn't expecting. I thought that was really brilliant, really well done. And then you get to see Tony with a family, and that sort of sets up the whole thing of, we can't go back and erase that 5 years. You know, you can't, because I did wonder whether they do a lot of messing around. I'm glad they didn't do that, because it almost turns everything prior to that movie then into this didn't happen. And you sort of don't want that. So
It was very clever use of the narrative, and I mean, we'll talk about it later, but there's one thing that some people are saying that was an error, they think, but other than that, they were quite honourable to the theory of time and the sort of the parallel springs of time. And hurrah for Tilda Swinton turning up, and that little demonstration for little me, who's not really into sci-fi that much, to do that demonstration of the time was quite, helped me, and that helped piece together the narrative. And then Banner going, you know, and putting the stone back in, and it bringing back the time. And so I appreciated that.
Yeah, I like the fact that they referenced Back to the Future. It's like, wait, you're telling me Back to the Future is rubbish? You know? The sort of the little things like that, I thought were quite clever, in that they're very much pointing out the fact that this isn't how they did it in Back to the Future. If you go into the past, it doesn't mess up your future timeline. You're creating alternative timelines, and the point you go back to is your main timeline. So there is a slight problem with the Cap stuff right at the very end.
That's exactly what I was about to say. I didn't immediately think of it, but my friend who came out with me sort of said, okay, there's a problem with that. And I was like, okay, is that a big error on the storytelling side of things?
Not necessarily. I mean, the argument is basically, if Cap had gone back in time and lived out his life with Peggy, he wouldn't have been there as an old man at the end. That doesn't really make that much sense, because he's not in that timeline anymore.
No.
He basically leaves that timeline and was in another timeline as an old man. The only possibility, the way round it, is that he gets to a point in his life where he then comes back to the main timeline and uses the device to travel back through time as an old man. But you didn't see any kind of reference to that at all. So it's possible that that's what they did, but it doesn't quite make any sense. The other thing somebody pointed out is, of course, Cap went back with the, what is it, 5 or 6 stones.
Yeah.
And they weren't all in stone form when they took them, which is another slight problem in that to go and put like the ether back, you've essentially got to turn it back into liquid and re-inject it into Natalie Portman.
I want to see that movie.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a whole film to be had of Captain America trying to go back and put all the stones back in the right place, because you've also got to put like the power stone back in the kind of thing which they smashed it out of to put it back in exactly the right position. Yeah. And you've got to wake up Chris Pratt to get him to kind of be not killed the moment the bad guys turn up in that sequence. Yeah. So there are issues with that, it's fair to say, but it was a lovely way of rounding everything off, but there are issues with it.
I can only imagine that Russo's had many ways of characters dying, but obviously they decided not to go down the route of killing off Cap, but they needed to find a new suitable way to say this is his end in the narrative, he won't be in phase four and this is why. Because I don't know about you, Dave, I think the first death was a shock to me.
Black Widow,
yeah. So I knew by the moment you saw those two going to Vormir, I was like, oh, hang on a minute.
One of them's not coming back. Yeah.
I know how the stone is retrieved from Vormir, but up until that point, I almost felt like it was her movie.
Yeah.
It was Scarlett's movie, just like Thanos had Infinity War. The first half of this film was her movie, wasn't it?
Which does bring up the other point in that there is supposed to be a Black Widow film coming. So
I think it's got to be prequel. It's got to be her time as a spy.
I suspect that's probably a prequel film, which would make sense, because I don't think they're going to be bringing her back. And I mean, they have essentially got a bit of a multiverse to play around with, because they've kind of established that there are alternate timelines out there, so that would be the other way of doing it. But I suspect it's probably a prequel film in the same way that most of Captain Marvel was, so I think that is probably what they're going to end up doing with it, but we'll have to wait and see.
There were lots of lovely little moments in the cinema, little rounds of applause, and I haven't been in a film where that sort of happened in the middle of the film. I've been in films where it's happened at the end, but there were just some absolutely lovely like appreciations of characters appearing. So quite early on, the first round of applause we got was for Korg and Meek. They're appreciated amazing characters, and like them appearing, the sudden realization that they did survive and get off the ship that Thanos destroyed. So they had a little round of applause. But then there were some brilliant moments as the movie went along, where people just completely appreciated what they were doing, and the characters that reappeared were just fantastically done. Did you get emotional, Dave?
No, I didn't. I apparently have a heart of stone, because I didn't cry at all. I know Matt went and saw it. I did a podcast with Matt, sort of the first thoughts, literally the afternoon after we both came back on the Thursday, because we both saw it Thursday. We did a podcast after that, and he said he cried at a few places, but I didn't, but I loved it from start to finish. I thought it was absolutely phenomenal. And I mean, you know, it was great to see how Tony went out and have Pepper come back and see Cap pass on the shield. So we still technically have a Captain America. It's just going to be Falcon from now on.
And it's not going to be the Winter Soldier. Everyone thought it would be Bucky.
Well, it had to be one or the other, because those are the two guys that have been doing it in the comic book. So it was always going to be one or the other. But I think a lot of people expected it to be Winter Soldier, but I'm happy Falcon got it. Falcon in the MCU, I think Falcon makes more sense as being the person to pass it on to. He's been sort of the closest ally of Cap. Bucky is great as a character, but you know, he's been on both sides of things, and I think Falcon he's more of a company man. You know, he makes more sense as the person that you're going to kind of pass everything off to. So I mean, I'm glad to see that.
I'm a bit dead inside as well, Dave, like you, but I had a few moments where there's a little lump in my throat, and I thought that was and they were quite unexpected. Well, one was expected, when the first time was when the first orange circle opened and Black Panther walked through.
Yeah.
That was the first moment I got a little lump in my throat. And the second moment was when Spider-Man or Tom Holland went over to Tony Stark.
Yeah.
And those two moments really got me, but I could understand why there are so many moments across especially the second half of the film that really got people. And it was quite nice again to have that complete richness of emotion, of comedy, of action, of intelligence as well. There was not it wasn't simple plot. It was really, you know, have that intelligence, have that complexity. Yes, the movie is smashing all records, but also appreciate the storytelling that a team so talented can interweave all these genres and that we appreciate them. And in the darkest and darkest of plots, if you think about where we came into, the humour that is carried through and done in a really sensitive way. I mean, a lot of it's done through Rocket, obviously.
But and Thor, of course.
Yeah, Rocket and Thor. And I just absolutely loved it. So I unadoubtedly give it about 10 stars or 5 stars or 6, whatever the maximum is. Beautiful. You know, we've read the press now over the weekend. It smashed every record that's going with regards to open the screens,
box
taking
office
money.
Is insane.
Yeah. The China, the Asia, Europe. It's and too right. It's the good payoff for what was meant to be. There are obviously lots of questions going to be asked. I got asked this morning. Warning only, do you think that Thor now joins the Guardians of the Galaxy? And I
was like, for the next movie, it looks very much like he is going to be in the next Guardians movie, which is fine. I mean, that was always fun when we saw it in the last Avengers film. I like that dynamic. I think it's good. So I think it's lovely to have Thor in there, and particularly this version of Thor, who's kind of overweight Thor, and that's great.
I mean, I also think that we've got a while to wait till Guardians 3, but it's going to be very much like the search for Gamora.
He does look that way, yes.
Yeah, and so that's what I thought that would be really honor. And then I even just speculated today. So think of the timeline. If that was 5 years, we are technically in 2023, and I don't think Guardians is going to be ready till at least 2022 once James Gunn has finished Suicide Squad. That's gone out. Yeah. Then starts the pre-production. So we could almost get Guardians of the Galaxy in the right timeline if we wait long enough.
That's true, actually.
Well, obviously, it now leads directly into Spider-Man. It does make sense. He's gone back and he's found his friend. So we do now believe Spider-Man with Happy as the new Guardian.
That is one other slight issue as well, because this is the one thing with it being still 5 years in the future. That means all of his friends must have been snapped away at the same time as him, because they're all still in high school. And if they weren't all dusted at the same time as Spider-Man or as Peter Parker, that doesn't make any sense either, because they'd all be 5 years older.
That's true. So there is, Ant-Man's daughter's older, isn't she?
Yeah, so there is that. That is one slight issue of it just so happens that all of Spidey's friends happen to be snapped away as well. So fine, you know, but you've suddenly got this bunch of kids that have basically missed 5 years of school are suddenly back in school again. That's a little weird, but
we're gonna have to see how they deal with that plot.
I think it's probably okay, and hopefully they'll reference it some. They may reference it, they may not, because this is a problem, of course, with it being a Sony Marvel film rather than a Marvel film. Whether they will reference that, I don't know, but that was the one other thing as well. And it's always a problem when you're dealing with time travel stuff. There are always going to be these issues.
But yeah, exactly.
I think to create a rounded film, they did an incredible job with it. And yes, there are a couple of little minor things, but I roll with it perfectly happily.
Same here. So the final thing to say is, like, good on them on keeping the full cast list as quiet as they did. I mean, we do go, some people appear but don't say anything. Marissa Tomei, Michelle Pfeiffer, Kobe Schmolders, Samuel Jackson all appear, don't say a single word, but the full rounded cast that you have in those final scenes is just something that you can epically say, well done, Marvel Cinematic Universe. You have paved the way for everyone to aspire to. And I think for me, Dave, that's the last of my spoilerific discussions on Avengers Endgame.
Yeah, it was absolutely phenomenal, particularly that whole sequence of the portals, and just incredible. We've finished with spoilers. If you've not seen it yet, go out and see it. It's an incredible, incredible film. I can't recommend it highly enough. So yes. So that's Endgame.
Yeah.
Anything else you've been doing this week?
Well, obviously I had Easter break, and that should have been a time where I caught up with lots of things, but I really didn't. I was just absolutely swamped with things. So I only got a chance to finish. I have like 3 episodes of Big Little Lies waiting to finish.
Still going to get to watch that, yes.
Yeah. So the new series is coming back in June, I believe. So I thought I finished that. Absolutely loved it. I wish I'd watched it now when it was on. Finally got into Future Man series one. I know you discussed that with me previously, but I'd never seen it. But I'm now two episodes away from finishing series one, and I've got series two lined up.
Yes.
I also, on a time travel thing, I think I was really getting my fill of it. I got up to date with Timeless in time for these final two episodes.
Oh, brilliant. So, yes.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the second one to come onto my TV, and then we're going to watch it like a movie. Like
that's probably the best thing to do. Yeah. I'm kind of annoyed that E4 didn't just stick them out back to back. It seems a bit ridiculous to split them over 2 weeks, but that's what they've done. So,
so let's think about current programs. I watched Line of Duty episode 5 last night, and oh my goodness!
I can't help you with this because I've not watched a single episode of Line of Duty, and I know it's on iPlayer, and I know I think it's on Netflix as well. So I will go back and watch it. It's one of those things that is by summer kind of catch-up thing that I need to do.
It's absolutely brilliant. I mean, I'm not going to give any spoilers, but the way they bring like twists and turns into the narrative is absolutely fantastic. I'm hooked. We're 5 seasons in, and I think it's one of the best dramas. I think it's better than Bodyguard that the BBC are putting out there. And last night, I just want to give credit, Anna Maxwell-Martin, fantastic actress. She's come in episode 5, so she hasn't been in the series up until now. She was just brilliant, and I think I sort of like give my praise to the performance that was given in this particular scene. So for people who haven't seen it, try and catch up, try and watch it. But people who have seen it, I hope you agree with me. Anna Maxwell-Martin was absolutely a brilliant performance yesterday. And a little gem I found on BBC iPlayer. So it's this BBC Three give up one night a week to show some of their best programmes on BBC One.
Yes.
And so this appeared in my feed. It's a programme called Back to Life. And it stars and was written by Daisy Haggard. And people might know Daisy Haggard from Episodes.
Yes.
Previous to that, she was in Uncle. And she plays this girl who's been away in prison for 18 years and is trying to sort of adapt herself into life. And it's a very dark comedy, but also a very, very strong performances. The narrative, again, has the dark comedy, but also very serious undertones of someone trying to adapt to their life back after this, obviously, situation she's been through. But we also don't know what she did, and it's coming out slowly. I just watched episode 3 this morning, and I'm starting to learn more about why she was in prison. But it's in the Fleabag slot, so people are talking about it as like the bit that's picking up where Fleabag isn't anymore.
Yeah.
But I think it's really good. If anyone likes those sort of 25-minute, dark, not obvious punchline comedies and wants to see it, it is very, very cleverly put together. And I always liked Daisy Haggard from when I first watched her in Uncle. I just think she's a really, really, really good performer.
Do you know, I mean, you know, having listened to the show, how much we love Uncle, and you know, we know the writers, and she's amazing. And that's one I might go and check out, actually, because I think she's brilliant. So
she's really good. And that's pretty much my very limited, I mean, I could talk about the 8 or 13 films I watched over Easter. Yeah. But, you know, I've already talked about them previously.
Yes.
So that's me. So Dave, what about you apart from Endgame?
Well, apart from obviously Endgame, I did watch another superhero movie. I finally got around to watching Aquaman. Wonderfully fun. I mean, considering it's a DC film and how dreary some of the DC movies have been up to now, I thought it was great. It's got lots of action. Jason Momoa is incredibly watchable in it, and it's silly, wonderful, stupid superhero fun. And it's obviously not up there with some of the Avengers movies, particularly Endgame, but it is a great, fun, silly film. And it's got almost bits of Indiana Jones in there. There's like a little segment where they're going to find a thing, and it sort of goes very indie. And then you've got some great underwater stuff. I think they do an amazing job with that. And it's well crafted, nicely put together. Some quite spectacular battle sequences in it, which I thought were really good. If you're looking for a fun entertainment, kind of take your brain out and don't think too much superhero film, perfectly watchable, perfectly entertaining. So yes, I really enjoyed that. that. On entirely opposite end of the scale, finally got around to watching The Case Against Anand Said. Case Against Anand Said is a HBO documentary series in four parts. And if you are familiar with the Serial podcast, he was the subject of the first Serial podcast, which got downloaded umpteen million times. It's basically a sort of TV version of that, but with some added extra stuff. They're following through the trials and appeals and all that sort of thing, and laying out stuff which they found pretty much since Serial was on air. So it makes quite a good companion piece. If you've listened to Serial, you will know some of it, but there is a lot of stuff that they've been dug up since then. That was fascinating.
And, I was a huge fan of Serial, and then I went and listened to a podcast called Undisclosed. So his aunt, Rabia Chowdhury, which you see in episode one, also had this podcast series called Undisclosed, and the first two seasons were about Adnan Syed, and I was a huge fan of the entire story. And so I tuned in and watched episode one a couple of weeks ago, but then I was waiting for them all. And again, I might just do a binge watch now. They've all come down onto my Sky. Yeah. But it is a fascinating case. And I think it's something that I believe in more than How to Make a Murderer. I know there's some similarities between them both, but the evidence and the way the case has been presented in the Adnan Syed case, I'm absolutely convinced of that narrative in terms of, like, you know, I am so such a follower, and I follow Rabia Chowdhury on social networks as well, because I'm continuously looking for the update, and I think it's a fascinating case, and, you know, it's a well put together documentary that sort of adds into the entire narrative behind it. So.
It is fascinating and really well put together. I mean, it's difficult because they are basically following one side of the argument. They're following the defense more than the prosecution, but it doesn't feel as biased as maybe Making a Murderer does. There is a lot of factual stuff in there, and you do look at it and go, how have they got to this point? This doesn't make any sense. So I would strongly recommend, particularly if you're a fan of Serial, go and watch that. It's brilliant. And the other thing, of course, was Game of Thrones, which I know we're recording this on Monday afternoon, and it won't have gone out for the evening showing yet, and we're not going to talk in spoilers about Game of Thrones last night. All I will say is I stayed up and watched it live because I could, and it's utterly spectacular. I do wonder if they're going to end up cancelling the Emmys this year or just handing out second place awards, because after last night's episode, Game of Thrones really should be winning everything. It was a spectacular, spectacular piece of TV. And I know you're not a Game of Thrones fan, or you've not been watching it, but honestly, some of the stuff, this is up there with one of the best episodes they've ever made, and it is one of the best episodes of TV ever made. So can't recommend it highly enough. Just quite, quite phenomenal. It was a major battle scene, and they've got another one coming on towards the end of this run as well. So there have been two big battle scenes this season. That's not really giving any spoilers away, because everybody knew this was a battle scene this week. I'm not going to say anything about, you know, who survives, characters, and all that sort of stuff. If you want to follow my thoughts on Game of Thrones, go and listen to the Reviewing Westeros podcast, which we do with Entertainment Talk, which is entertainmenttalk.org. I do that with Matt, who co-hosts on here every so often. That'll be out on Wednesday, so go and pick up that. We've been doing that since Game of Thrones came back. It's on entertainmenttalk.org. It's called Reviewing Westeros, but you can hear us talk with spoilers and give us thoughts about the whole show over there. So that's all the stuff we've been doing this week. Let's move on to some TV and film news. So we start off the TV and film news, as ever, with renewals, cancellations and pickups. Big cancellation, which really upset quite a lot of people. Netflix have cancelled the Santa Clarita Diet after three seasons, which seems to be a bit of a trend for Netflix at the moment. They seem to be cancelling shows after three seasons. They've done it to a number of things recently, and this is sort of the latest one to get stuck with that. Unless it's a major, major breakout hit like Orange is the New Black or something like that, or, you know, or it was pre-ordered with multiple seasons over three seasons, like The Crown, which was pre-ordered for six seasons. Mm. They seem to be dropping the hammer after three seasons, unless it's a big awards winner, like Kimmy Schmidt, I think, was quite a big awards winner. And Santa Clarita Diet got a lot of fans, seems to be a very well-liked show, but isn't kind of hitting the award categories as much. I mean, I don't know whether it's the numbers are down on it or what the problem is, but yeah, they've decided that after three seasons, they're not bringing that back again, which is a real shame because it was kind of different. This is the thing about Drew Barrymore becomes a sort of zombie, but she's not a sort of mindless wandering around zombie. She's still getting on with life. She just happens to eat hearts and is kind of with her husband trying to cover it up, basically. Mm-hmm. And she's just a suburban housewife. So it was a really kind of nice, interesting, different comedy. And it's a shame to see that go, but they've decided that they're not going to renew it after its third season, which has recently gone out.
Yeah.
Over on the CW, they've actually renewed a record 14 seasons this year because they've renewed a bunch of other things. They've renewed things like all the DC CW shows and all that sort of stuff. They've now renewed The 100 for season 7. They've renewed All American, which is their American football drama, which I didn't think was going to get picked up again, but they've decided to give that another shot. In the Dark, which is a new thing, which has only just started over there, and Roswell, New Mexico, which is the kind of new revamped version of Roswell. They've both got second seasons, or they've all got second seasons. So, 14 seasons they picked up.
I'm kind of thinking what CW are sort of getting their reputation as the renewal station.
Yes.
But what they do is they renew, and then maybe a few weeks or a few months later, they determine with the writers that it's the final season. So that's what they did with Arrow, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So they originally renewed it. And I remember us talking about they renewed everything. And then a couple of months down the line, they did a more official sort of saying, the Arrow have decided, you know, this is their final season. So I think they are very much a station that are looking for the natural end to a story rather than them being, they really give the creators control. So I wouldn't be surprised in that list, obviously we've got some really good ones and the 100 still on season 7. I wouldn't be surprised if one of them, we get an alert in a couple of months time going, the writers have decided to end it with that season.
Yeah. I mean, that wouldn't surprise me in the slightest with the others are getting second seasons, so they're probably going to be around for a bit longer, but it is very, very rare that the CW do actually cancel anything.
Yeah, exactly.
They have got a lot of shows finishing this year, like Jane the Virgin was one of theirs, so that's ending. Arrow's ending. iZombie's one of theirs, that's ending. Supernatural will be ending. So, you know, they have got a number of shows coming to a conclusion, but I don't think they actually cancelled. They certainly didn't cancel any freshman shows this year.
No.
They picked up all their new shows, and because they've got a number of things coming to an end, they have now still got space to be able to put new things on. Plus, one of the big changes they made last year was they went to 7 nights a week, which apparently they hadn't been doing. They didn't put any original programming on Sunday. It was all repeats, I think, or they didn't air at all on Sunday, which is
okay.
Weird, but they're now using Sundays as original programming. So that was something they didn't do before. So they've got a little bit more space than they had done in maybe previous years. So it's not greatly surprising that they've renewed a record kind of 14 seasons, but it's great news. I love the CW for that. The fact that they do let things come to a natural conclusion, which is wonderful. So hopefully, you know, it's always a good sign. I mean, if I was writing a show for US Network, the CW is the one that I want it on, because you know it's going to you've got the best chance possible of it staying there. The worst chance possible will be off if it's on NBC, because they don't give anything a chance. But CW, that's the network you want to be on if you want your show to survive. Over on CW sister station CBS, they've renewed The Good Fight for season 4, so that's good news. And they've also renewed NCIS Los Angeles and NCIS New Orleans, which join the main NCIS in renewal this year. So all the NCISs are back, if you were a fan of that set of shows. which is great. There's also talk of them possibly doing a JAG spin-off, which is JAG was the show which spawned NCIS in the first place. And now NCIS Los Angeles is having a couple of the people from JAG guest starring in the finale of this season. And there's talk that that may create a new JAG reboot. So it's this kind of, you know, the snake eating itself at the moment, because you've got kind of, you know, JAG spawns NCIS LA, which possibly spawns JAG. So
yeah, another one.
Yeah, that may or may not happen, but there is, we'll have to see how well the finale goes down. But yes, there is a possibility that you might get JAG back on air as well. In terms of pickups and advanced air dates, Sky One have picked up the Cinemax martial arts drama Warrior. That's going to air in June. This apparently is based on early writings of Bruce Lee. It was an idea that Bruce Lee had, and they kind of have formed it into this TV show. It was apparently something which he had pitched to a few networks, and he always argued that they turned it into Kung Fu, the David Carradine show. And he always argued that that was a ripoff of the idea that he pitched. This seems very different to that, in actual fact. But this seems almost like a sort of martial arts drama mixed with Peaky Blinders, as far as I could tell, which is a really interesting idea. I mean, set in America, but it's that sort of time period in America, which looks really interesting. So it's going to air on Sky One, which is odd because it feels more like a Sky Atlantic show, but it's coming to Sky One in June. That. So if you're a fan of martial arts, that could be one to watch. I don't know much more about it than that. And Designated Survivor Season 3, that now has a premiere date, also coming in June, 7th of June for that, on Netflix and around the world. Only 10 episodes because it's now a Netflix show, not, which was a Fox show before, wasn't it? So only 10 episodes because it's now a Netflix show, but they will all drop at once. And I'm very happy to have that, to keep a Sutherland as president, which I really enjoyed the first show of that. So that's great. I'm glad to have that back. 7th of June for that. Moving on to bigger news, HBO have commissioned a new Armando Iannucci series, which I think we've probably talked a little bit about before, called Avenue 5, which sees him step away from the political drama, which is all political comedy that he's been known for up until now. And this is a new comedy set in space, and it's space tourism it's about. So it's created, written, and exec produced by Iannucci, set 40 years in the future, stars Hugh Laurie as Ryan Clark, the charming and in control American captain of the Avenue 5, a space tourism vessel. He's joined by second engineer Billy McAvoy, who is played by Being Human's Lena Critchlow, and Zach Woods, who you'll know is Jared from Silicon Valley, who plays Matt Spencer, the head of customer relations. On the ship, there are, of course, passengers. One of those is Rebecca Front, who has worked with Iannucci before on The Thick of It, and she was in Humans. Plays Karen Kelly, who is illicitly aboard the Avenue 5 and using her sister's non-transferable ticket. And Spike Martin, played by Ethan Phillips, who you will know is Neelix from Star Trek Voyager, playing an elderly space enthusiast, former astronaut, and a grizzled womanizer and heavy drinker. It's also got Josh Gad, who you will probably know his voice as being in Frozen, and he's playing Clark's boss, Herman Judd, who's the billionaire behind the Judd Empire, which includes hotels, fitness clubs, and space tourism now, and owner of the Avenue 5. Judd's right-hand woman is Iris Kimmu, who is played by Susie Nakamura, who has been in Dr. Ken and the Goldbergs and Blackish. And Nikki Amuka Bird, who was in Hard Sun and Luther, stars as Rav Mulclair, who is head of Judd's mission control on Earth.
Such a good cast.
Yeah, it's a really solid cast. I mean, it's no great shock, because Armando Iannucci is one of those guys that if he rings you up and asks you to be in something, you say yes.
Yeah, so, yeah. You know. I'm still waiting for the call.
Yeah, exactly.
He hasn't called me yet.
No, I know. But I see when they sort of talked about the passengers and the fact that it's basically a space hotel, I did wonder if you're kind of heading towards an almost Fawlty Towers in Space kind of idea, which is sort of what it could possibly be. I don't know if that's the case or not, but that's sort of the thing that stuck in my mind, is the idea of you've got these kind of interesting collection of passengers You've got this really amazing cast. You've got this person who is, I mean, as I say, charming and in control captain of the Avenue 5. I think the in control is probably in air quotes, which is the Hugh Laurie character. And I don't know, I sort of feel this maybe kind of aping that sort of hotel comedy, but set in space.
Well, I love Veep, and so I definitely would be viewing this. I know it's sci-fi, Dave, but if it's got the political humour side to things, I think I definitely would be into it. So
I think this is kind of interesting because you don't get that many straight sci-fi comedy stuff, which and it's going to be interesting to see Inucci do something which isn't straight politically based either. I mean, I'm sure politics will creep in there to a certain extent somewhere, but you know, he's been involved with things like Alan Partridge as well. So I mean, he has done non-political stuff, but he's mainly known for Veep, the thick of it. He was involved in The Day to Day, Death of Stalin, which was the film that he did more recently. So it's the same team behind it. It's Inucci, Kevin Loder, Simon Blackwell, Tony Roach, Will Smith, not that Will Smith, another Will Smith. It's got his standard team behind it who really know what they're doing. I think this should be brilliant. It is a HBO show. They haven't given a premiere date yet. Hopefully, will probably be later this year, early next year. It should come onto Sky Atlantic if it's a HBO show because of the carriage deal they have with HBO. But we're waiting to hear a bit more about it. But that is called Avenue 5. It's going to be one to watch out for, I think. Sticking with HBO, they've got another sci-fi drama in the offing. This one coming from Joss Whedon, who is finally returning to doing TV drama of his own making. He did have some involvement with Agents of Shield, but that's sort of more his brother and sister-in-law's show than it was really him. He sort of helped them out and getting out the door, and obviously had an attachment to Marvel through Avengers and that sort of stuff, but it's not really had that much day-to-day involvement with it. The new show that he's making it for HBO, it's called The Nevers. They've announced the lead actress in it is going to be Laura Donnelly, who you might know from Outlander, played Jenny Fraser-Murray in Outlander. She's also appeared in Britannia and popped up in episodes of The Fall, Missing, Casualty. She was in Merlin as well. So great actress. The Nevers is a sci-fi drama, but it's an historical sci-fi as well, so Laura Donnelly's really in her element, having come from Outlander. It's about a gang of Victorian women who find themselves with unusual abilities, relentless enemies, and a mission to change the world. Donnelly plays Amelia True, who's the most reckless, impulsive, and emotionally damaged hero of her time. A menace to the stuffy Victorian society, she would die for a cause and kill for a drink. So it sounds like a really interesting character, very much Whedon's kind of wheelhouse. You know, I mean, he writes brilliant female roles, things like Buffy and Firefly and that sort of thing. So I'm very much looking forward to this. I think it could be fabulous. It's also got ex-Buffy writers Jane Epstein and Doug Petrie in it as well, involved in the co-writing of the series. So it's very much a kind of Buffy alumni team up, which I'm really excited about because I adored Buffy. And it's Joss back on TV making TV shows on his own terms and at HBO, where he has a lot more control over it. So I think this could be fabulous.
I will eagerly await your review of it.
You can't even tempt you. That's terrible. HBO gave The Nevers a straight to series order. They haven't yet given a release date, but the earliest it's possibly going to arrive is the autumn this year. It could well be into 2020. It depends how long they take to pull everything together. We'll have to wait and see. Again, it should appear on Sky Atlantic in the UK due to the carriage deal with HBO, but we'll let you know when we hear more about it. And another sci-fi thing, so just up your street. This is Nickelodeon have commissioned an animated Star Trek series. Now, this is different to the other animated Star Trek series, which we've previously talked about, which was called Lower Decks. That sounds like a brilliant premise because Lower Decks comes from some of the guys behind Rick and Morty, and it's based on one of the lowest serving ships in the Federation's ranks, in kind of, you know, and it's kind of the cleanup guys, basically. That's the sort of premise of Lower Decks. This is going to be slightly different. This is going to be an original CGI animated Star Trek series. It's aimed at a younger audience, which is why it's going out on Nickelodeon and not CBS All Access, where all the other Star Trek stuff is. Follows a group of lawless teens who discover a derelict Starfleet ship and use it to search for adventure, meaning, and salvation. So kind of a different thing for Star Trek to be diving into. It's been developed by Emmy Award winners Kevin and Dan Hageman, who are some of the people behind the Lego Movie and Troll Hunters. It's overseen by Ramsey Neto, who is the animation production development executive vice president at Nickelodeon. We knew that they were going to push a lot new Star Trek content out. I mean, obviously we've got Discovery, that's coming back for a third season. They did those Star Trek Short Treks, which were little sort of 10-minute Star Trek episodes. We've got the Patrick Stewart series, where he comes back as Jean-Luc Picard, Lower Decks. There is a new project that is based around Section 31, which is in development with Michelle Yeoh attached to star, reprising her Star Trek Discovery character. So there's lots and lots of Star Trek things out there, and they've, I think, got more things on the cards as well. So I don't know. This is quite good, because it's a way of getting Star Trek into the, you know, the kids into Star Trek, and sort of funneling an audience through. I guess that's the plan for it. But yeah. Whether it's something I'll watch, I don't know, but we'll have to wait and see. And we don't know where it's, you know, if and where it's going to go out over here, whether it will end up on Netflix, who have got all the other Star Trek stuff, or whether Nickelodeon will take it over here as well, because we do have a Nickelodeon channel over here. So we'll have to wait and see. But yes, interesting. If you're a Star Trek fan, it would be one to watch out for, I think. So that's all the news we have for this week. Next, we have the interview.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The interview this week is with Ryan Shaw, who is the composer on Star Wars Galaxy of Adventures, Star Wars Forces of Destiny. He's a two-time Emmy Award and Grammy Award nominated composer, songwriter, musical director, conductor for film, television, virtual reality, games, records, concerts, events, theatres. Basically, if it's got music in it, he's had something to do with it at some point. The other thing he's been doing recently is a VR film called Cave, which is premiering, or is probably premiered by now, at Tribeca Film Festival, which is going on at the moment, which is really quite interesting, because although it is a VR film, it's a shared immersive experience where the entire audience is wearing VR headsets and can sort of see each other within the film. So that's an intriguing idea, and we talk a little bit about that as well. We also talk a little bit about the fact that he was assistant music director on the 87th Academy Awards. I think he did the 88th as well. That's got to be a horrendous, nerve-wracking experience. Lots and lots of things to talk about with Ryan. Here he is. Here's Ryan Shaw. We will see you afterwards with some highlights for next week on TV. It's really nice to have you on and come and chat through some of your work. Should we start off with a little bit of background? How Sure. did you get into composing in the first place?
Well, I first got into music when I was 11 years old.
Right.
And I started with the saxophone, and I later added the clarinet and flute and piano. And the beginning of my musicianship was all in playing, just being an instrumentalist. And yeah. I love it. Playing in a lot of bands, a lot of different styles of music. A lot of jazz, big band combos, classical music, Latin, R&B, you know, a bunch of everything that you would play with a saxophone.
Yeah.
And it was sometime around when I got into college, I went to Berklee College of Music, and I had to pick a major. So I picked film scoring. And the reason I really got into it was because there were just so many sounds that I wanted to explore musically, you know, different styles, different genres. And there were all these different styles that a saxophone wouldn't necessarily be in it.
Yes, of course.
And so that's really why I got into composing, was it was a way to explore all these other types of sounds, you know, like, you know, more classical or bluegrass or gospel or, you know, all the, you know, choir, rock band, all these types of things that maybe saxophone wouldn't be there. So that's really when I got into it. And I majored in that in college. And then when I graduated, I moved to New York City and lived there for about 8 years. And I moved to New York because I have an uncle, Howard Shore, who is also a composer.
Right, yeah.
And so that's what brought me to New York. And I started working for Howard for about 4 years. And then after I was in New York for about eight, then I moved out to LA to continue scoring film and TV and video games and virtual reality. And I've been out here for about 15 years.
Ah, cool. Yeah, no, I hadn't made the connection that Howard Shore might be a connection to you, but yes, very famous composer.
Yeah.
What type of saxophone did you play? I only ask because my brother used to play saxophone, had a baritone, and it used to shake the walls of the house when he used to play it.
I bet it did. I love that. So I started out on alto sax,
right,
and later picked up a tenor sax, soprano sax, and the baritone sax, like you're mentioning.
Yes, yes. Amazing, if very, very loud instrument.
It can be, and it takes a lot of air.
Yeah.
And I love playing the baritone, particularly in horn sections, you know, where you can play at the bottom of the section.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So the couple of projects, really, that we're probably going to talk about more than anything else. But we'll start off with the Star Wars related things. So this is Star Wars Galaxy Adventures, Star Wars Galaxy Adventures Fun Facts, and Star Wars Forces of Destiny. These are all up on YouTube. They're kind of animated shorts. But do you want to just explain a bit about those for people that might not have seen them?
Sure. So the first series that I scored for Lucasfilm is Star Wars Forces of Destiny.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, much of this material is up online, and they're constantly adding more. Mm-hmm. Forces of Destiny, well, I would say that probably all three series in some ways share a common focus, which is introducing newer audiences, younger audiences to the Star Wars universe.
Yeah.
And so these... all three of these series are in short formats. I think most episodes of Forces of Destiny, those were a little bit longer. And then Galaxy of Adventures, they're about a minute or so, and Fun Facts are about a minute or so.
Right.
But they all serve sort of a common purpose, which is to introduce these newer audiences to Star Wars. The musical approach for each one has been a little different. On Forces of Destiny, I utilized John Williams' themes, and everything in the series I composed originally, except for his themes. You know, I would quote his themes.
Yeah.
But all of the composing was all original. And when I would use his themes, I would do new treatments of his themes, and I would create all of that music as well. Galaxy of Adventures is a little different because the series at times recreates, in a way, some iconic scenes from the films.
Yeah.
And so in that series, we are often utilizing original recordings of John Williams from the original films as best as we can.
Right.
And then the scenes aren't necessarily recreated like shot for shot. So sometimes the original score may not fit the scene in exactly the same way because the timings have changed.
Right.
And so with those, I try and do some very creative editing with John Williams' music. And then I fill in before it and after it and during it, and sometimes, you know, bridging things together with original music so that hopefully it sounds like one continuous score and it's not detectable as to where John Williams begins and ends and where my original score begins and ends.
Interesting. Yeah, because I've obviously been on and watched a few of these, and I would never have guessed that was not all original score, but obviously I knew you'd done work on it, so I knew some of it had to be. But yes, you really wouldn't know. So then Fun Facts is slightly different as well. This is sort of fun facts about various things like the Rebels or the Emperor or that sort of thing, isn't it? So what about the approach for that?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So Fun Facts will focus on various characters, various worlds, various types of technologies, where an episode might be like, you know, this is a lightsaber and here's what you can do with a lightsaber, or, you know, here's Luke Skywalker and here's about his character. So for that entire series, I would say musically, the Fun Fact series is probably the most different of the three, because Forces of Destiny and Galaxy of Adventures proper, I guess I would call it, is a very orchestral, traditional acoustic approach.
Yeah.
Very much cut from the same type of cloth that John Williams established for the entire Star Wars films. Fun Facts is different because I actually don't use the orchestra at all, and it's completely electronic and very, very contemporary. there's a lot of just non-orchestral sounds, and that's the entire score. And I don't quote any of John Williams' themes for that. So I've created new themes for Fun Facts. So Fun Facts sort of sounds the most different of the three.
Yeah. How did you end up getting involved with Lucasfilm and the Star Wars stuff in the first place?
I was introduced to Lucasfilm through my friends at Ghostbot. Ghostbot is an animation studio that created all of the animation for Forces of Destiny.
Right.
And they're good friends of mine. We'd worked on other projects prior to working on Star Wars. And when they signed on to create Forces of Destiny, they reached out to me and they said that they were working on a series, a new project. I think they said a new project for Lucasfilm, but they couldn't tell me anything about it. They couldn't say anything. So I didn't know it was Star Wars.
Yeah.
But they asked if I would be interested to be recommended to score it. And I said, of course, you know, and it's Lucasfilm. So in my mind, I'm thinking, well, it's possible this could be Star Wars, but I don't know. And so they were kind enough to set up a meeting where I was able to speak with one of the producers on the series, still not knowing it's Star Wars. And I was able to ask a few questions so that I could sort of put together a reel of my music that hopefully appealed to them. Hmm. It's kind of funny how it came about, because the only directive they really gave to me about the kind of music they're looking for was just adventure music. But as you know, as I know, you know, adventure music could be so many different things.
You know,
Indiana Jones is an adventure. Pirates of the Caribbean is an adventure. Avatar is an adventure. Hmm. But all of these are vastly different worlds and vastly different types of music. And so I asked the producer one question while I was on the phone. And I kind of kicked myself for asking it because I didn't want to pry. But you know, I said, of course, please don't, you know, I don't want to know anything I'm not supposed to know. But I want to ask one question, which is, do these stories take place on Earth? And they said, no, they don't take place on Earth. And I said, perfect. That's all I needed to know, because now in my mind, I immediately am thinking, okay, maybe it's in space. You know, maybe this is fantasy. Maybe this is science fiction. But I know it's not an Earth, you know, based story. Yeah. And of course, speaking with Lucasfilm, I'm immediately thinking maybe this could be related to a Star Wars property. So I sort of adjusted my reel and I sent it over kind of with the hopes that this might be Star Wars. And after they heard my reel, they shortly after that asked me to score the series. And that's how I first got involved. And that was Forces of Destiny. And then after I was done with that one, Lucasfilm reached out and asked if I would be interested to score a Galaxy of Adventures and Fun Facts. And of course, my answer is yes, immediately. It was such a great phone call to receive.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got involved with Lucasfilm.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that if it's Lucasfilm, there's only really two big franchises that they work off, which is Star Wars and Indy, I guess. There's not, you know, most of the stuff is related around that. So if it's not Earth-based, it kind of has to be Star Wars or something entirely new. So
yeah, it's a good percentage or good chance.
So what was your sort of first reaction when you did discover it was Star Wars and you realized you're going to get out to kind of play around with the John Williams sandbox, I guess?
Well, my first reaction was, boy, I wish my ceilings were a little taller because I was jumping up and down so much. I'm like, why don't I have taller ceilings than 8 feet? So my first reaction was just over the moon. I couldn't believe it. And then my next thought was, boy, this better, you know, I better make sure my work is good. You know, yeah. So like kind of a one shot deal. So I just couldn't wait to dive in, you know, when they started sending me footage and things to work on. Of course, it was massively inspiring and just got right to it.
How much of a mark are you thinking you can make on this? Because there is an established style with the John Williams stuff.
That's such a great question. And that's something I've given a lot of thought to over the years. My honest answer is, and it would be the same really for any project that I'm scoring, which is I really begin first by looking at the story, talking with the filmmakers, talking about what they're looking for musically, what we want the audience to feel, what we want this role of the music to be within the storytelling, if it's going to be used for establishing time and place or characters or a sense of pacing or a sense of size or scale or, you know, all the usual normal sorts of thoughts that would go into crafting a score for anything. And really, like, the last thing I think about is how can I consciously sort of do something I might do that would gel or hopefully gel with all the above. I usually don't even think about that at all. I like to think of myself in a way as a bit of a chameleon, that I'm there to serve the greater picture, the greater, you know, the greater storytelling among a team.
Yeah.
So that being said, I mean, that's my process. You know, that's what I'm thinking about at any given moment. Whether it has some kind of touchstone to something else I've done or a way that I write, not to sound cheeky, but I kind of feel like maybe that would be for other people to assess. You know, maybe they hear things that are sort of common threads. But if there are or if there aren't, it's really not something I'm consciously thinking about. I'm really just thinking about what's the best music to write for this scene at this moment at this time.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. And it's going to be interesting moving forward as well, because obviously we're coming up to the final movie of this massive epic saga this year on the big screen. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of other Star Wars projects floating around. And it's sounding like this is probably going to be John Williams' last one as well. So the next big Star Wars kind of trilogy film movie, I think there's going to be a sort of battle of the composers that have been working on Star Wars of sort of see who can win out and get the next big gig. but the problem is people are always going to expect, I mean, not so much a problem, but people are always going to expect that John Williams style in there, I think, as part of it. So I'm very intrigued to see where musically the whole of the Star Wars universe kind of moves to post the end of this saga.
I completely agree. I mean, John Williams obviously has established the entire musical vocabulary for Star Wars. And I'm starting to hear, you know, like as more Star Wars projects develop, some different sounds that are getting peppered in, you know, some little electronics, some different things. So I too, I'm really curious to see, you know, how it develops. I love the approach that John Williams has created, you know, of the classic orchestral approach.
Yeah.
It's so timeless to me. And I feel like there's a certain kind of, well, I guess timelessness would be the comes to mind, you know, because the sound of an orchestra has been so well established for so many hundreds of years. It's really, you know, stood the test of time.
Yeah.
So I'm really curious to see how it develops myself.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting moving forward. Is there a particular piece that you've done for either Galaxy Adventures or Forces of Destiny which stands out to you or was something you particularly loved working on?
Oh my goodness, there's so many. There's an episode that sort of stands out in my mind in Galaxy of Adventures. I think it was, I'm doing the title by memory, but I think it's Luke versus the Death Star.
Right.
And it stands out to me because I was able to approach it in a way that was a little different than how the music was treated in the original film. And I was able to quote the Force theme at a time, you know, when Luke is attacking. And it was an idea that we chatted about, you know, amongst the filmmakers. And I just love the way it kind of came out, mostly just because it was sort of a rethink of that moment of how it was treated in the original film. So that's one scene that sort of comes to mind. But there's so many. I know there's another, I don't remember the title, but there was an episode within Galaxy of Adventures that almost is like an episode that is propaganda for the stormtroopers. And it's just cool. You know, it's just a whole different sort of approach to something we haven't seen, you know, from the films.
That's really interesting. Are you going to be doing more stuff with the in the Star Wars universe? Do you know, or would you be allowed to tell me if you were? That's the other thing.
A lot of things are kept under wraps, you know, until they're announced. So even if I have something, I would not be able to talk about it. But right. I will say that I absolutely love working with Lucasfilm. I love working with all my friends there, and anything that they would want me to be a part of, I would love to be a part of in any way at all.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. A few other projects you've been working on recently. There's the VR film Cave, which is premiering kind of any moment now, actually, at Tribeca Film Festival, I guess, which is what they're calling a shared immersive experience. So the entire audience is in VR,
yes,
which is a really interesting idea. So how did you get involved with that? And what's your sort of approach for dealing with music within VR?
I've been fortunate to be working in VR now for a handful of years. Cave marks my fourth VR film. It's incredibly inspiring to work within VR. And there's a lot of really creative work that's being done. So Cave has a really cool approach to it, as you mentioned, where it's designed so that multiple audience members are able to wear a headset at the same time. Everyone who is in the audience who's watching appears within the film.
Oh, wow.
as an avatar. So you can sort of see a representation of everyone who is there. And we can all have this shared experience of watching a story together. Cave particularly is about a story from very, very long time ago, where there is a young woman who is sort of hearkening these spirits in order to be a shaman to her people. And it's a really beautiful story. I was able to sort of do a lot of research with Scandinavian music. We decided to look at folk melodies from back then. The score is sort of a hybrid between orchestral and traditional Scandinavian folk melodies.
Oh, interesting. Did you acquire any interesting new instruments to work on that project?
Yeah. There were some sort of indigenous flute sounds that I was using, some percussion. I sort of wove it all into the score. So it's this blend between, you know, traditional Western music and, you know, heritage type music. So yeah, I would say most of the instruments that I included were like blown instruments, you know, like flutes and things, and hand percussion.
That sounds really interesting. Hopefully we'll get to see that at some point. That could be quite a good one. Even as a solo experience, I guess that could be quite an interesting one to watch.
Absolutely.
There was one other thing that you worked on, which I just wanted to talk to you about because I thought this must have been terrifying to do. The 87th Academy Awards, you were you kind of involved in that, on arranging and orchestrating and composing on that, working with a whole bunch of different people. That's got to be high pressure, because if you screw that up, you're doing it in front of like every single A-list actor and all your peers. So
yes, I noticed that when I was working on it. Wow. What an incredible experience it was to work on the Oscars. I should start by giving huge thanks to my friend Stephen Oremus, who is the music director that year.
Yeah.
And Stephen reached out and invited me to be his assistant music director. And what an incredible experience. You're correct. There was a lot of pressure. It's a massive amount of moving parts in a relatively short amount of time. And just the names of the people who come through or are part of the discussions, you know, like Lady Gaga and John Legend and Common and Tim McGraw and Adam Levine, Jennifer Hudson. I couldn't believe it. I mean, at any given moment, like the next legend walks in the door and is warming up or we're concentrating on their performance. It's an experience I'll never forget. And I also have to give massive props to the LA musicians who are out here, who play on all the scores and TV shows and projects. To work with them on the Oscars is nothing short of astounding, what they are capable of doing. There is just a massive amount of music that the orchestra is tasked to play, whether it's quoting, you know, themes from all the various nominated projects, to play on music, to bump outs to commercials, rejoins from commercials, the in memoriam, the special music material for all of the songs, you know, all the song performances, the opening number. You know, there's just so many music needs throughout the evening.
Yeah.
And these musicians can change styles at the drop of a hat. It's like turning the knob on a radio to a different station. And it just changes stations and you're immediately into like this new style of music, and it's flawless.
Yeah.
And that's what they're capable of doing. It's really astounding, incredibly challenging music that sometimes we would only get a chance to play once or twice. It would sound perfect the first time. It's an amazing thing to view and to hear.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're great, amazing bunch of people to work with, I'm sure. And yeah, just phenomenal names. It's something to experience again sometime, maybe, once mm-hmm. you've got over the doing it the first time.
It's incredible. I would love to be a part of it in the future. I actually did have a chance to work on the Oscars the following year. So I've worked on it 2 years in a row. And that was because Lady Gaga, the first year, she was performing a performance from The Sound of Music.
Right.
And she'd also done a song with Diane Warren called Till It Happens to You. So I had a chance to work with Gaga twice that year. But then the following year, that song, Till It Happens to You, was nominated for an Oscar.
Oh, wow.
And so Lady Gaga came back to perform for the second year. And since I had worked on that song, I was able to come back to work on it again. But yeah, if there were more opportunities to work on the Oscars, I would love to do it. It's an incredible experience.
Awesome. So just going to throw in the last two questions, which we always ask people when they come on. So the first one is, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
Oh my goodness, that is a good question, because we watch a lot of television. Like every night, you know, we're on Netflix and Hulu and Prime and we've been watching a lot of Grey's Anatomy recently.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I think that's what we've been watching. But we watch a lot of stuff. I don't know, Broad City, Sarah Silverman, Amy Schumer. You know, we've been watching a lot of comedy specials. Sometimes I watch Bob Ross, who is great with his painting.
Yeah. Very relaxing.
Yeah. We watch a lot of programs about space. I've watched The Cosmos.
Oh, that's
with
great.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, probably 10 times through that entire series.
Wow. It's a great series, that.
Oh, my God. And Alan Silvestri's music is brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an amazing series, that. And lastly, if you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, past, present, or future, not one you've already worked on, which show would it be?
Oh, there are some TV shows that I've kind of been following that are going to be coming up. I'm hesitant to mention them because there are a few that I'm really interested in. So I want to be mindful about, you know, how I campaign for them. One thing I will say is that I love working within different genres. And that's something that I've been fortunate to do throughout my career. So they span a lot of different styles. You know, some that I'm interested in are quite epic and large, and some are for general audiences, and there's, you know, animation and things. So that's something I've always enjoyed, is keeping a really good variety of projects. And so when I'm thinking about projects that are coming up, that's often what I'm thinking about too, is, you know, how to keep things musically interesting and work on different types of things.
Cool. Well, thank you for spending a bit of time to talk through your stuff. It's been lovely to have you on. I'm going to go and watch a few more of the Star Wars animated things on YouTube, the Forces of Destiny and Galaxy of Adventures. Go and watch a few more of those.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dave, for having me on the program. It's really a pleasure.
It's been lovely to have you. Hopefully we'll talk again soon when you've got some new stuff coming out.
Awesome. I look forward to it. Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Cheers.
Bye. So that was the interview with Ryan Shaw, the composer of the various Star Wars animated shorts and stuff. As I said, you can find Star Wars Galaxy of Adventures and Forces of Destiny and the Adventures Fun Facts. All of that stuff is on YouTube, so you can go and look it up on there. Just Google it, you'll find it. Next up, we have some highlights for next week on TV. So only a few highlights for next week. We have Bloom, which is the show we were talking about last week. It's coming to My5, which is the Five streaming service. It's an Australian drama which centres on life in an idyllic country town a year after a devastating flood kills five locals and a mysterious new plant is discovered with the ability to restore youth. No idea whether it's any good or not. I think it's got a couple of seasons though, but worth going to look at. That's coming to My5. It's called Bloom. That's on the 1st of May, you can find that. Dead to Me, the first season of that, that's coming to Netflix on the 3rd of May. This is a dark comedy starring Christina Applegate about a powerful friendship that blossoms between a tightly wounded widow and a free spirit with a shocking secret. There's a trailer up on the website for this if you go and search for Dead to Me. Looks really interesting, but it's Christina Applegate returning to sort of comedy, although it's much darker than that by the looks of things. Also on Netflix, we have iZombie that is returning for its 5th and final season. Brilliant zombie dramedy series. I'm really looking forward to see how that finishes. 3rd of May for that on Netflix. And again, that's another show that Matt covers over on Entertainment Talk, so you can go and listen to him broadcast about that. Speechless, 3rd season of that, which is following pretty much directly on from the 2nd season. That's coming to E4 on the 6th of May at 7:30. Hilarious, that comedy. Well worth going to see.
Really good, yeah. I'm enjoying that. I'm watching season 2 at the moment, so yeah.
Really funny. Minnie Driver as the mother of 3 kids, the eldest of whom has cerebral palsy, and it's just hilarious. Really, really brilliant. I love that show. And Chernobyl, that is a mini season coming to Sky Atlantic, which you can't fail to have seen. If you've looked at Sky Atlantic, they're trailing it everywhere. 7th of May at 10 p.m. for that. 5-part mini series about the Chernobyl disaster. Jared Harris, Stellan Skarsgård, Emily Watson, Jesse Buckley, a whole bunch of other really high profile names starring in that. Looks like it could be really good and very interesting. So Chernobyl, 7th of May at 10 p.m. for that.
Excellent.
That's everything we have for this week, unless you've got anything else you would like to mention.
No, come on over and follow me on Twitter at GrayTheGeek. If you are downloading, listen to this on Tuesday, 30th of April, wish me a happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And carry on the Avengers chat if you want to chat anymore. We are about to go into the long summer, so I look forward to catching up with everybody next time on the podcast and see where our summer has got us. As I lead into one of the tough terms as for us teachers, where we have to get all the exams done and things like that.
For us, you can find us on the website at geektown.co.uk throughout the week. Keep on checking the website, especially at the moment. There is a lot of news going up. We're about to hit a major, major point in US TV where all the renewals and all the cancellations come in over the next couple of weeks. So there is a lot of news going up daily. That's at geektown.co.uk. So go and check that out. If you want to get in touch with the podcast with questions and comments, email us on podcast@geektown.co.uk. Leave a message on the website post. Find us at Geektown on Twitter, on Facebook at facebook.com/geektown, on YouTube at youtube.com/geektown, and on Instagram at geektownuk. That is everything. We shall see you next week. Bye-bye.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.